Welcome to Torah Timechanach Yomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Liat Meyerfeld, and today we are learning Melachim Aleph, Chapter 4. There are list people, and I'll just wing it people. Just wing it people may find lists overwhelming and restrictive. They like flexibility and suspense. List makers will tell you that lists give clarity as to what there is and what isn't. List makers often have fun guessing what will be on the list. They love being proven right. Spoiler alert, that won't happen in this chapter. If you're not a list person, brace yourself. This chapter is list-heavy and technical. After last chapter's story of King Shlomo deciding which is the real mother by offering to saw the baby in half, it might be hard to equal that level of drama. So we swing over to the other end of the excitement spectrum, tedious lists. We will have to find the drama between the lines. Ancient Israel longed for the very structure that now emerges. With Shlomo firmly established as king and Israel secure from military threats, a detailed account unfolds listing the significant bureaucrats in Shlomo's court, including his advisors and military commanders. Additionally, the narrative delves into the 12 governors overseeing the kingdom's districts, along with descriptions of the geographical features of each of the 12 regions. The success of any empire depends on effective government. This administrative framework aims to uphold the moral values of the Torah consistently. Shlomo needs a solid team of people working for him. Without bureaucracy, all the wisdom and all the religiosity wouldn't come to fruition. The chapter concludes with a sense of tranquility. Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sands of the sea. They ate and drank and were content. This promise of prosperity through good governance, rational administration, and ethical policies derived from Torah principles offers hope for Israel's flourishing. Shlomo's commitment to impartial justice, disregarding social status, fosters contentment among the people. The aspiration for a government rooted in morality, administered with reason, and applied equally persists from ancient Israel to modern democracies. We yearn for order. Although tedious, we crave it in our lives. As individuals, we continue to dream of a society where safety, prosperity, and justice prevail, ensuring consistent access to sustenance, fulfillment, and happiness for all. Let's look at what ministers there are in the kingdom. There's a scribe, there's a secretary, there's a minister of the army, there are priests, there is the king's companion, which means a friend, a personal advisor, often a trusted relative. There are ministers responsible for collecting taxes, a lot of them. Why is this so interesting? Because a mechanism of ministers answers the question, what is important to this country? Do you know, for example, that in the United Arab Emirates, there's a position called Minister of Happiness and Well-being? There's also a Minister of Opportunities and Investment, a Minister of Youth Affairs. These all show the Emirates' focus. The list of ministers and local governors in King Shlomo's administration is not just a list, but also a very important window into his priorities and the political agenda and methods that he chose to use in order to govern his wealthy kingdom peacefully and successfully. And in Shlomo's kingdom, if we look at the list, it seems that there are fewer army ministers than in King David's, more priests and more economic ministers. Of course, King David spent much of his time in battle, expanding his kingdom and securing its borders. We see in contrast that security isn't on King Shlomo's agenda. He inherits a nation at peace and instead emphasizes the priesthood, as he would need Kohanim in his monumental project of building the temple. And finance ministers to fund it all. The kingdom is developing from survival mode to creative mode. King Shlomo preferred a small government. His abundant country did very well with 11 ministers only. Guessing the list of ministers will be easy. The ministers came from the families that were most loyal to the king. One of them was the prophet Natan's family. Natan had supported Bathsheba's efforts to give the crown to her son, Prince Shlomo, and not Prince Adoniah. In return, his two sons were appointed ministers in King Shlomo's government. The loyal servants of King David, army commander Benaiah, and Kohanim Tzadok and Eviatar were appointed ministers in King Shlomo's government as well. Two others were the husbands of Shlomo's daughters, so it all remains in the family. In verse 3, we are introduced to Elichoref and Achiah, two scribes. The Talmud tells an amazing story about them. Once upon a time, it happened that Shlomo met the angel of death and saw that he was sad. When he asks him the reason for the sadness, the angel of death replies that he needs the two scribes sitting before the king, indicating Elicharaf and Achiah. Shlomo hears this and immediately sends the two of them to the faraway district of Luz, which according to another midrash is protected from the angel of death. When they reach the gates of Luz, though, they die. The next day, Shlomo again meets the angel of death and sees that he is laughing. Shlomo asks him, "Why are you laughing?" The angel of death replies to him, "Where I needed them, that's where you sent them." King Shlomo had some kind of revelation where he understands that these two scribes are meant to die. He tries to avoid this. They are useful to him. He feels close to them. He then learns that even if he has understandings beyond this world, he cannot change another person's destiny. The Talmud adds that Shlomo then said, "A man's feet are his guarantor and responsible for him. Wherever he is needed, there they lead him." The Midrash compares him to Hillel, who lived a few generations later. He sees a skull floating in the water. The Mishnah there in Pirkei Avot quotes Hillel saying that this person got exactly what they deserved because of their actions. Here King Shlomo also learns that a person's actions have direct repercussions, and everyone ultimately finds themselves exactly where they are meant to be. We must remember that these chapters are the chapters that on the one hand try to build Shlomo in our minds as a wise and prudent king who does not make mistakes. In the previous chapters, we met with his wisdom in local politics and in understanding people and relationships. And here, in a chapter that is almost technical, the Midrash finds a way to integrate Shlomo's wisdom. But it has this question: is Shlomo really wise? What is evident is that he is making an effort to learn from experience, and that develops wisdom. Next, a list of governors for each tribe. If we try to guess them, we will not be as successful. But it's a trick question. We can't guess all 12 officers because there is no officer listed for the tribe of Yehuda, King Shlomo's tribe. It seems that the royal family's tribe had extra rights, was free of taxes, and had no need for a local governor to collect taxes that it did not pay. By mentioning that each of the governors besides Yehuda paid taxes 1 month every year, our chapter tells us that the tribe of Yehuda indeed have extra rights. We have also seen that some of the leaders have familial connections to the king. This emphasizes King Shlomo's method of governing. For better or worse, short-term goals perhaps over long-term vision, King Shlomo currently values loyalty and family above all. In the division of the country into 12 regions, we would have also guessed 12 sections according to the 12 tribes' inheritance in the days of Yoshua. We'd be wrong. For the first time, we have a leader who's thinking outside the box, a leader who said to himself, "The land of Israel is situated at a crossroads, which was perceived by all previous rulers of the land as a danger and a problem that had to be solved. I will flip this over and use it as a strength. A crossroads? So be it. We will trade with the world, gain from transit custom fees, and strive to live in peace with all neighbors and travelers instead of seeing them as a threat." When we look at the cities mentioned, it's again not just a list. Some big cities surrounded by walls and bronze gates. Some small cities, but we know they had economic ability because they are situated on the shore or have natural resources, for example. In modern-day Israel, it would be like making a list and mentioning the nuclear Dimona and the mineral-rich Dead Sea and tech startup city Tel Aviv. Shlomo understands that it's no longer possible to manage such a diverse country with a tribal concept. For the first time, he perceives all of Israel as one complete unit. This concept is necessary if one wants to develop an economy based on international trade and not on local agriculture. For that, we'll see in the next chapter, he decides that he also needs a large and fast chariot army instead of David's foot army, for that he needs international connections, and for that he needs political marriages with all the kings of the region. Yirmiyahu, we see in all chapters, can be subtly cynical. Maybe most importantly, for that new setup, King Shlomo needs a new mindset of the people. It seems to me that Yirmiyahu is trying to tell us a story of identity, about the identity of our ancestors, and also about our identity today. So how can a clerical list do something so profound and philosophical? Easily. Because more than anything, it's clear that Yirmiyahu was trying to tell a story that cancels the previous identity stories. Although there are 12 governors, there are certainly not 12 tribes, and the geographical division is not the division of the tribes. The officials, the people of the technocracy, know the big secret. There is nothing like a casual and matter-of-fact list to create consciousness, to mark the boundaries of the sector, to signal to those who need it, here or in thousands of years, that the story has changed, that the identity is no longer the same identity. Their identity will change from a religious tribal one to an economic one. And I imagine those common people whose identity is still tied to their tribal identity, whose family and village people mark their belonging and connection, who may not even understand why they have to work a month a year for the distant king who sits somewhere. And maybe they resent the senior official who was appointed by that king, and they have trouble understanding how all this belongs to their lives. The chapter ends with verse 20. Yehuda v'Yisrael rabim kechol asher al hayam larov ochlim v'shotim usmechim. Yehuda and Israel are numerous like the sand that is on the sea, eating and drinking and happy. There is a king in Jerusalem who keeps the peace, bringing stability and comfort, so all his people are eating and drinking and happy. Or perhaps not. This chapter ends with materialistic comfort, eating and drinking and happy. Nowadays, it might be written to say, "Eat, drink, and be merry, tomorrow you may die." Bureaucracy is working, life is orderly, This is what the people originally wanted, and everyone sinks into a very physical life. There is clearly nothing spiritual here. Yirmiyahu is saying the obvious has become not so obvious. Eating, drinking, and being happy are not the essence of life. Rabbi Yosef Kaspi, a scholar and philosopher in the 13th century, already read the verse with the displeasure and wrote, "If only there were also sages and scholars learning Torah and discussing wisdom. Were there even a few, as in the case in other generations? The crowd is the crowd, but there should also be thoughtful, spiritual people who know that practicing Torah and delving into its wisdom is the main thing." This verse prepares us for the next chapter and for all chapters in history. Indeed, the lady does protest this too much. There are those who eat and drink and are happy, but there are also those who work, suffer, groan, and are not happy. Not happy physically or spiritually. And suddenly we realize why we are told specifically about King Shlomo taking Pharaoh's daughter as his wife. Avadim ha'inu leparo b'mitzrayim. We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and perhaps we still are. Thank you for studying together, Lilui Nishamot Imoteno Ekarot, Esther Oppenheimer Alea Shalom, and Sarah Shanker Alea Shalom, each deeply devoted and proud to transmit their family's Torah legacy to the next generations.